Bien, bonjour. Nous continuons aujourd'hui notre examen des sources archéologiques sur le commerce entre l'Empire romain et l'Orient, et principalement l'Inde. Et j'ai invité notre collègue Robert Attenberg à venir nous parler. C'est principalement une céramologue. Et j'ai une très grande admiration pour son travail de céramologue. Elle a été la spécialiste de la céramique de presque toutes les missions archéologiques du désert oriental. Le Mons Lodianus d'abord, puis le Mons Porphyrites, ensuite Myos Hormos à Kosser Al-Kadim, et désormais à Bérénice, où elle s'apprête à aller prochainement. Mais ses compétences multiples l'ont aussi amenée à travailler au Yémen, en Inde, où après une étude générale des céramiques antiques venant d'Occident, elle est désormais partie prenante, ô combien, de la fouille de Pattanam dans le Kerala, qui est le site probablement identifiable au fameux port de Musiris, bien connu par les sources antiques et principalement par le périple de la mer Érythrée. Elle travaille aussi dans la péninsule d'Oman et elle est ainsi à même de couvrir l'ensemble des données archéologiques sur le commerce multiface entre l'Inde, le Golfe Persique, l'Arabie, l'Afrique de l'Est et l'Égypte, c'est-à-dire donc l'Empire romain. Sur ces sujets, elle a écrit un grand nombre d'articles et de chapitres de livres, notamment dans les publications de fouilles. Et un article, entre de nombreux autres, a fait sensation. C'est celui qui s'appelle « Rome in Mesopotamia and Portus into India in the First Millennium AD », paru dans Antiquity en 2007, où elle a dévoilé un pan nouveau du commerce qui avait été jusqu'alors confondu avec le commerce de Rome à cause de la ressemblance des jarres produites dans la Mésopotamie, des jarres qu'en anglais on appelle « torpedo », des jarres « torpilles », qui, lorsqu'elles sont réduites à l'état de tesson, peuvent ressembler à certaines amphores romaines, mais elle a montré qu'elles se distinguaient par plusieurs caractéristiques, notamment par un enduit de bitume à l'intérieur, par l'absence d'anse, et elle a aussi expliqué pourquoi il faut les distinguer. Elles devaient certainement contenir du vin, mais pas de l'Empire romain, du vin probablement produit dans le royaume sassanide, et surtout elles sont plus tardives que la majorité des amphores romaines, datant de l'Antiquité tardive, et donc ça redimensionne en quelque sorte les flux commerciaux à cette époque. Plus récemment, en 2008, elle a donné une remarquable synthèse sur le commerce entre l'Inde et l'Empire romain, que j'ai apporté ici, qui s'appelle « Indo-Roman Trade, from Pots to Pepper », qui a le mérite d'être très dense. C'est une courte synthèse, mais qui est très bien informée par des informations de première main. Elle est partie prenante de la plupart des fouilles qu'elle cite. Et c'est donc une source essentielle. Elle a longtemps travaillé au Museum of London et elle est aujourd'hui Visiting Fellow au British Museum depuis 2002. Et elle a été, entre 2002 et 2004, Research Fellow de Southampton University. Et vous comprendrez pourquoi, puisqu'elle a travaillé avec cette université sur le site de Myos Hormos. C'est donc aujourd'hui la meilleure spécialiste de la céramique antique de cette région du monde que nous accueillons. Céramique qui est le témoin principal, car indestructible et bien datable, des flux commerciaux, même si, grâce entre autres au périple de la mer Érythrée, nous savons que les marchandises les plus importantes de ce commerce étaient les étoffes, les épices, l'ivoire, les pierres précieuses, les perles, qui, bien entendu, ne laissent pratiquement aucune trace. Donc, il est temps, après cette brève présentation, que je lui laisse la parole. Elle fera sa présentation en anglais, mais elle le parle de façon très distincte et lentement. Et elle a eu la gentillesse de préparer son PowerPoint avec des légendes en français. Donc, je pense que vous pourrez suivre avec facilité, et ensuite nous débattrons de quelques points qui font discussion encore, et je ne doute pas qu'un certain nombre de nos collègues qui sont dans la salle seront intéressés à discuter avec elle. Je lui laisse la parole.
Thank you so much for that introduction and particularly for the invitation to be here today. I'm very happy to be here, speaking about Egypt's Red Sea trade to the Malabar coast. I'm going to start out this talk by thanking a number of institutions and colleagues for their funding and for my participation on their projects, because as you'll see from this talk, the research, I was able to conduct this research because of collaboration with so many institutions, which is really the nature of archaeological work. And in particular today, I'd like to thank three institutions for the use of their photographs. The University of Delaware and Steve Sidebotham for pictures of Berenike, University of Southampton for pictures of Kusair al-Qadim, and the Kerala Council of Historical Research for pictures of Pattenham. Now, this is the context of the research that I'd like to talk about today. And as you can see here, the sites on the Red Sea were ideally situated for contacts with both the Mediterranean through Alexandria to Africa and further east. Now today, in my title, I've concentrated on going as far as the Malabar coast, which is here. In fact, we're going to touch a bit on the Bay of Bengal, this coastline, but the more important contacts were with the Malabar coast, so this is hence my title. Now today what I'd like to do is take a chronological approach and look at the Red Sea from earliest times through the late Roman period, and during that time, look at the changing connections with India. On this map, as you can imagine, it comprises many, many different social and political situations that come in contact with each other. And no more is this more seen than by the number of different languages that are present on documents on the Red Sea coast. And they represent all sorts of sources of evidence, from coinage to this lamp here in Coptic, which don't represent those ethnicities on the site, but are just items of trade, to other items that represent visiting foreigners on site, such as this Palmyran inscription from Berenike. Even from the non-literate evidence, we can get interesting insights, such as this graffiti swastika on a piece of Egyptian pottery, which may have links with Indian traders. For a very long time, the study of Indian Ocean trade was dominated by the documents. But in the last 20 years, we have had a plethora of identification of different kinds of goods that were traded across the Indian Ocean. And as Jean-Pierre said in the introduction, I specialize on the ceramics. And these are just a few of the ceramics that are well provenanced and which traveled across the Indian Ocean for a variety of different reasons. So for instance, we have a whole range of pottery that served different functions, from cooking pots to the more well-known Roman storage jars, fine wares that were for the table. So all these different pottery types traveled for different reasons, but they all give us an insight into the connections throughout the Indian Ocean at this period. The more exotic goods that actually drove the trade, such as the spices and the gemstones, silks, and other textiles, of course, are extremely important, but today we'll be concentrating more on the evidence for the trade in these other goods through the pottery. And just to give you an idea, before we start the chronological description of the Red Sea, these are the sites across the Indian Ocean which I've had the opportunity to study the pottery from. And of course, by looking at different sites in different areas, it has given me the opportunity to compare the assemblages in a way that isn't possible if I was just looking at pottery from the Red Sea. Now, the two sites that I'm going to concentrate on the Red Sea are Kusar al-Qadim, or ancient Mias Hormuz, which was occupied, or we have archaeological evidence, from approximately the late 1st century BC to the mid 3rd century AD, and Berenike, which we have evidence from the 3rd century BC until the early or mid 6th century AD. So it was a much longer lived occupation there. And I'm going to start with the earliest occupation at Berenike. The excavations there have been conducted over a long time period, unfortunately with a gap between 2001 and 2008, when we were not able to have permission to work on site. But since 2009, we have been excavating and plan to continue. The site was established in 275 by Ptolemy II, and we do have deposits that date to this period. One of the most interesting deposits that we've followed is this V-shaped ditch, which is interpreted as being a pen for herding elephants. The reason for this is the justification of the actual foundation of the site, that this was a port that was used to bring elephants from Africa to the Roman Empire for military purposes. And this was a very specific, quite limited kind of trade, and it's reflected in the artifacts that are found during this period, because we have a very small range of materials that are found. So in terms of the ceramics, it's primarily Egyptian pottery and a few things from the Aegean, but we don't see the flourishing of goods from across the Indian Ocean that I will show you later. Now we have three main Ptolemaic areas that we're excavating. This is the first one. The second is a very substantial tower, defensive tower, that has been robbed out, which dates to approximately the same period as the elephant pen. And it's quite well dated by this stamp on an amphora from the island of Rhodes. And the third Ptolemaic feature is this defensive wall that has been primarily robbed out. Now, it's with the annexation of Egypt in 30 BC that we really see a change in the character of the trade on the Red Sea. It ceases being an entirely military instigated trade. It becomes much more economic, and it becomes much more intense. Just how much more intense, we don't really know, because it's difficult archaeologically to characterize the volume of the material. But we see both an expansion of the sites on the Red Sea and expansion of the material that reaches these sites. And staying at Berenike, one of the most famous monuments on this site is what has been known as the Temple of Serapis. And it was first recorded in the early 19th century by Belzoni, and it has been looked at subsequently by a number of different scholars since then. The University of Delaware excavations in the early seasons did not do any excavation or any exploration of this monument because it was better known than other features on site. However, after we had our gap, when we were not there, it was slightly vandalized. So we took this opportunity to clean it up a little bit, and since then have started a campaign to re-excavate it. And this is just the one room of that building that we've thus far excavated. I call it the Temple of Serapis in quotations because although there was a bust that had an inscription to Serapis, it is also dedicated to other Egyptian gods. So the main function of the shrine is not that clear cut. To give you an idea of some of the other features that occur in this early Roman period, from approximately the 1st century BC to the 3rd century AD, we have a lot of very rich rubbish dumps, which are common in Egypt, and which frequently many organic finds are preserved in them. This is an example of one of several dog and cat burials that we have found on top of the early Roman trash dumps. Now, obviously, the function of these sites as ports means that we were very interested in their port features, how they facilitated the trade. And this is one wall from Berenike, excavated in 1995. But until recently, we did not have that much information on the actual port itself. But it more recently, in the more recent campaigns, has become a focus of our exploration. And with a lot of coring and magnetic survey, we have located a lagoon area, which we then excavated. Now, what we've actually got here is an area adjacent to that lagoon, the lagoon having silted up. And we had a series, possibly, of workshops here that contained very, very large timbers, possibly from boats, and also very thick ropes. And we may have an area where ship repair was undertaken. At some point, it was very heavily burnt, so this material was charred. And you can see here one of the timbers, and most of them are made of cedar wood. Now, importantly, this area of the lagoon at Berenike seems to have been silted up and therefore no longer in use at about the mid-second century. And after that, the focus of the harbor would have shifted within the site. Now I'd like to just go further north to the site of Kusair al-Qadim, which has been excavated twice. Firstly, by the University of Chicago, and they excavated a series of buildings, one of which is shown here. And they, because of certain written evidence associated with the site, suggested that it might have been ancient Lucas Leman. The second campaign was undertaken by the University of Southampton, and prior to excavation, through the use of satellite imagery, it was suggested by David Peacock that this site might be ancient Myles Hormos. And you can see here the modern harbor, the modern coastline today, and what we subsequently learned was the silted up harbor. And it points out a very important point, not only at, just at Miles Hormos, but at all sites, of how substantially the coastline may have changed since antiquity. And we do really need to investigate this aspect of the archaeology if we're to understand how the ports functioned. As I said, David Peacock suggested the site was Miles Hormos. An excavation at the site subsequently did confirm that identification. And particularly here, we have a loan agreement that was excavated there that twice mentions the document having been written at Miles Hormos. And there are other features that indicate it was a very important port site, which we'll see that from the material remains. We did at Kuser excavate some buildings, and this is the main, most substantial monumental building that we excavated. But the primary focus of these excavations were on a number of sabak, or rubbish dumps, which were very rich in finds, and particularly on the harbor area. So my colleague, Lucy Blue, made over 100 test pits throughout the silted harbor area and analyzed the sediments in them in order to understand better the location and the history of silting of the ancient harbor. Now, as we excavated the ancient harbor, we came up with this feature that contained hundreds and hundreds of near intact amphora. At its height, at its greatest exposure, it measured about 60 meters. And it consisted primarily of local Egyptian amphorae and Italian wine amphorae of the first century BC AD. Now, this feature served two purposes. First, it formed a jetty, and it also was a way to consolidate the soggy soil between the lagoon and the site. Later on in the occupation of Kuser, there was a retaining wall built behind it, but this jetty of amphorae was the most significant port feature that we found. And this is a reconstruction by Steve Sidebotham of what that jetty might have looked like when it was functional. And you can see that there's a row of amphora and it's covered over with a hard surface, which gives you a better idea of how that previous deposit worked. Now, similar features are known elsewhere in the Roman Empire. You can see their distribution is primarily in Northwest Europe. And so the one at Kuser provides us the most easterly example of this sort of technology. Ours differs slightly from the ones found in Europe in that many of the European ones have wooden frames to help support them. The wood resources were probably not available in Egypt, so different methods were used to consolidate it. Now, turning to the type of goods that were found here, what we have is really an extraordinary range, both of Egyptian and Mediterranean finds and of finds from across the Indian Ocean. And you can see here the very beautiful glass probably made in Egypt, suggesting that some of the goods that were being transported to the Indian Ocean stayed in the ports, so that the inhabitants of the ports may have had some access to the more valuable items. The same is true of the Roman pottery, and this is just a quick shot to show you the sort of variety we have in Roman pottery, from the amphorae, which are imported from throughout the Mediterranean. Then we have fine wares from Italy, from Tarsus in Turkey, and local Egyptian ones. So we have a very, very wealthy assemblage found on these port sites. Moving to the finds that are come from the Indian Ocean region, I'd just like to briefly mention these jars from Saudi Arabia. And after that, I'll primarily be focusing on objects from India. But it points out very nicely that in addition to the trade with India, we have lots of other trade routes that functioned either as part of the Indian trade or in some cases probably as separate routes. So Saudi Arabia was very important for the Roman Empire because of the trade in frankincense. And one indication we have of this trade in frankincense is these storage jars that contain, we don't know what they contained, but they definitely did contain something, because many of them have plaster stoppers still sticking to the inside of their mouths. And a percentage of them are also lined, some with beeswax and some with bitumen. This sherd is particularly interesting, for not only does it confirm the source of these pots, primarily from the Hadramaut and also from up here in Dhofar, because of the South Arabian inscription on it. You can see here in the dark letters are an inscription that was made before the pot was fired, and the same symbols occur many times over in post-firing, so a graffito of someone who owned this jar. This is a small range of the type of Indian finds that we find on the Red Sea, and which were ultimately intended for the Mediterranean, but many of them do not preserve as well on the Mediterranean. So we have here, well, grains of rice. This is possibly a bit separate. This is likely to be just food for the Indian sailors. The black pepper, which I've mentioned before as being very important to the trade with India. And this is a piece of teak. There was a lot of teak wood found on site, and like in this case, it was reused in some of the walls. Here are a selection of stone beads from India that would have gone throughout the Roman Empire. And more functional, this is a bit of Indian sailcloth. We know it's a sail because it has a braille ring attached to it, which would have been used for mounting on the mast. In addition to the organic goods, which and the luxury items, which preserve, well, particularly the organics, preserve better in Egypt, we have some pottery with Indian inscriptions. So this, interestingly, is an Italian amphora that has an Indian inscription on it. It has a personal name written on it, which is the most common type of inscription that we get in these Tamil Brahmi graffiti. And this, another personal name, is an Indian storage jar. So we can see from these two evidences that We don't know where the graffiti were written, but we can see that the Indian sailors had access to the foreign goods as well as to the local goods. The bulk of the pottery, of course, does not have inscriptions on them in foreign languages. And this is an example of two of the biggest and most complete Indian ceramic vessels that we found on site. And these were set in situ, as you can see them, just north of the Serapis Temple from the first century AD. And this one still contained 7.5 kilos of black pepper. So again, we see here that the goods intended for the Roman Empire were used. They were plentiful enough to be used on site. At this point, this is a selection of some of the Indian pottery that is found on site. These are black fine wares and storage jars, cooking pots. Now, interestingly, we know that these cooking pots come from North India by their clay. And these cooking pots I was particularly interested in because they were the most common type of Indian pottery on site. And I'm going to return to them in a moment. Oh, just to summarize very briefly some of the patterns on the Red Sea during this early Roman period, we can see that particularly the port technology, there was very little infrastructure put into it. The sites, apart from the religious buildings, do not have large monumental architecture. What they do have is they have an astonishing diversity in Mediterranean artifacts and an equally matching range of material, particularly during this period from India and Saudi Arabia, although we do see some material coming in from East Africa at this period. Now, as I said, I was particularly interested in finding the source of these Indian cooking pots in order to understand the trading partners with Berenike and Myos Hormos. To look for them in India was quite a big job because they were made everywhere during the early historic and early medieval period, and in fact, they're still made today. So in order to try and find the source of some of these cooking pots, I really had to narrow down the search. Luckily, a number of the pots, the largest percentage in this category, had these very distinctive, deep, organic wiping marks on them. And from that, I decided to focus on these pots. They were quite distinct that I might be able to locate their source in India. So I set off to look at early historic assemblages of pottery from sites which were known to have other Roman material. So, of course, at this time, the best known site, this was in 1998, the best known site for Roman material was the site of Erichimedu, which has been extremely well known for a number of reasons. Firstly, because of the quantity of Roman amphora found there, the largest of any site in India at that time. Also because it was excavated by Sir Mortimer Wheeler, who introduced the stratigraphic technique of excavation into India from this site. Now, because of the high profile of this site. It has gained a lot of importance in Indo-Roman trade. And I'm not saying at all that it's not important, but it did form a bit of a discrepancy because all the written documents told us that the West Coast was more important, but here on the East Coast, we had really the only site that was producing material of this nature. So, like I say, it was the first place I obviously went to look for my wiping marks on my Indian pottery. And although I found many cooking pots in the style, the general shape, I didn't find any that had the wiping marks. You can see here, it's very plain inside. Now, I mentioned already that the West Coast was thought by the documents to be more important than the East Coast of India. And this is a quotation from the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, a shipper's guide written in about the mid-first century AD that paints a very vivid picture of what was exported in and out of different ports along the Indian Ocean. The area of Limerica refers to what today is the Malabar coast, and the writer knew that this coast was very important, and it was particularly important for the black pepper. And just as an aside, I will say now, because we'll return to this point later, it's interesting that he also mentions goods from elsewhere in India. So we have a lot of interregional trade within India. And now I'll just diverge for a moment just to point out the two kinds of pepper. We have the black pepper, which I've mentioned before, and this is actually the Baron Nike black pepper, which was very widely exported for culinary purposes during the Roman period. But we also have the long pepper, which was much more expensive, and it was more important for medicine and ritual purposes. So it's the black pepper that we're concerned with here. Now, in 2003, when I went back to India to look again for these cooking pots with scraping marks, I did especially want to go to the Malabar coast because to try and find evidence for this in the area which was most important to the Indo-Roman trade. At that time, there were no published assemblages from the early historic period from this area of India, the early historic being concurrent with the Roman period. But I was fortunate to meet up with colleagues in India who had been doing surface collection on this site at Patanam. The area is very heavily built up. They were fortunate that if someone was constructing within the village, they were able to look a bit below the surface. And in their surface collections, they had already found these two sherds of Italian amphora. The setting of the site is very rich. It's in a area where pepper is widely grown. And just again to return to the theme of black pepper, black pepper is a vine that attaches itself to the trunk of a tree. And all these are the pepper vines. And you can see here the kernels while they are still on the vine. So the setting of this site was very much as described in the Periplus. In addition to the Greco-Roman sources, there's a large body of literature of epic poetry known as the Sangam poetry. And they talked about a pepper exporting site known as Mucciri, which is the same as Musirus, the Greco-Roman name from the Periplus, a very important port on this Malabar coast. And not only does the Sangin literature mention the pepper, but it also gives us a more precise location of being near the Periyar River. So to return to the ceramics, to my Indian cooking pots, I was very happy also to find from Patna, and well, happy doesn't really describe it, I was ecstatic to find from Patnam similar organic wiping marks. So I felt in this region of India, I had really found the source for the bulk of my Indian cooking wares. The question then that raised itself was whether this site at Patnam could be the site of Mucciri or Musirus. And in the region itself, the site of Musirus had long been associated with this site shown here, where there was a Portuguese fort and earlier occupation layers. The only problem with associating this site with Musirus, or the main problem, I should say, is that there's no early historic material as yet been found there. And although there have been a lot of excavations by the Archaeological Survey of India, still no early historic remains have been uncovered. The main reason for thinking that this site was Musirus was, one, that it had ancient material, even if not quite ancient enough, and two, was its location on the Periyar. And you can see from this satellite image the Periyar River here and the fort at Kadungalore. So it fit in very nicely with the location as described in the documents. However, another stream here, this paleo channel known as the Periyar Thodo, would have been a much bigger body of water in antiquity. And it, the main body of water, through time, has actually migrated northwards. So what we see as the Periyar River today is a new location. During the early historic period, the main course of the Periyar River would have been here. So this puts the location of Patnam nearer to the description of the ancient texts and puts it in the framework for being ancient Musirus. And just to give you an idea of what we mean by a small stream, this is the Periyar Thodo today. Now, obviously, these surface finds were extremely exciting, and they warranted a full-scale excavation, which was undertaken in 2007 by the Kerala Council for Historical Research, directed by P.J. Cherian. And as I mentioned before, there's very heavy occupation in this region, and also heavy vegetation. You can see houses back here. So it's been a very big job just to get access to the archaeological deposits. This is a map showing the main area of the village. The yellow spots are existing houses. The brown ones, and I think there are quite a few more now because there's about 40 trenches have been excavated. The brown ones are the archaeological trenches. The site itself, the main mound seems to be about 45 hectares, but it's possible that the area actually is more like 70 hectares. Now, in the first year of excavation, there were extremely exciting finds. There was this log boat adjacent to a wharf area. And we can see here also bollards, which would have been used for tying up the boats. And the carbon dates for this phase of the site, because it's a very long-lived site with the Roman contact period sandwiched in between it, fit very nicely with the amphorae that were uncovered from this area, which was late 1st century BC, early 1st century AD. Other features that were excavated include this large brick building, function as yet really not determined, but it could be a warehouse. At many, many pots which seem to have been placed in the ground and used as installations, and this particular pot is Indian. In fact, most of these installations, in fact, probably all of them are Indian pots. Now, many of the trenches don't have obvious features, but all of the trenches, I would say, have an enormous and exciting range of archaeological material. And concentrating on things that come from the Roman world, we have some gold foil beads here, pillar molded bowls, and a carnelian intaglio, which of course would have, the carnelian itself would have come from India, but it was probably worked in the Roman Empire and came back possibly as a personal possession of a merchant. And this is really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the range of finds. Local finds include gold and these mostly pieces of jewelry and a range of local coinage, Chera coinage, and a lot of stone evidence for the export of beads from this site. These glass beads here, which were made in India or Sri Lanka probably, and which we found in great numbers at Berenike and Kusair, a whole series of cameo blanks, which would have been exported, work stone, and also a lot of stone debitage, which suggests that in addition to exporting the items from here, they were also working them. And as a regional center for export, we also find pottery from throughout the Indian subcontinent. But of course, my main interest was the Roman amphorae that had been found there. And to date, over 6,000 sherds have been excavated. I've probably looked at just over 3,000 of them. The bulk of these are amphorae that carried wine, but we also have small numbers for oil and garum, Roman fish sauce. And this is a schematic drawing just to show you the different types of Roman amphorae that have been identified to date from Pattenham and their sources in the Western and the Eastern Mediterranean. The most common type of amphora at Pattenham and elsewhere in India is undoubtedly this very characteristic type, which was made throughout the Roman Empire, made in almost every province as a container for wine. And so here I put the number 4, and if you look on the map at all the 4s, these are the different source areas of this container type found in India. This map is a little outdated. There's now some additional sources, such as these amphorae from Spain. And this is to give you an impression, really, of the distribution of, particularly, this is the Italian amphorae in this form as they're found across the Indian Ocean. And the Italian ones are probably named in the Periplus text, and they relate to what is known in the Periplus as the Italica amphorae. And we had these, they were very plentiful at Kusair al-Kadim and at Berenike, and these are just some examples of the Italica from the jetty at Kusair al-Kadim. Now, this is a map of the distribution of early Roman amphorae in India. You can see it's quite widespread, and importantly, there's areas that we would expect to find amphorae, but because of their dense occupation, they can't be excavated. So for instance, there are ports up here mentioned in the Periplus that would undoubtedly have large assemblages, but they can't at this time be excavated. So we'll just look at the evidence that we have at this moment. And we have really, of all these sites, these two sites, Patnam and Erikamedu, are the only ones that have Roman amphorae in any substantial numbers. The others are in small numbers, whether that is because of the small size of the excavations, that is probably one reason, but I think there are other reasons. And if you, we know that Patnam had very frequent and intense contact with the Roman world, and we think that Romans were probably living there. So that some of this Roman wine, and particularly the fact that we also have oil and garum there to sort of complete the trinity of Roman foodstuffs, would have been for the merchants who were staying there. And interestingly, it is only at Patnam and Erikamedu that we find the oil and garum containers. Elsewhere in India, we only find wine. And wine would have probably been more familiar to the Indian palate than particularly garum. It's possible that a similar argument that I'm advancing for Patnam, that some of the amphora were for foreign merchants living there, applies to Erikamedu as well. Many of the vessels on inland in other sites, I think, were probably the result of gift exchange between merchants and foreign elites, because they certainly, they're not enough to really qualify as a commercial exchange at other sites at this point. I think it's important also just now to point out the very strong similarities between the amphorae assemblages at Patnam and Erikamedu. There are some differences, but primarily we see the same types occurring at both sites, which really stresses the relationship between those two sites, which I will come back to. Very briefly, a look at the sigillata, which is found only at three sites in India and in very small numbers. And again, I point this out really to draw attention to the correspondence between Patnam and Erikamedu. If we look at the sigillata assemblages where green represents the Italian sigillata, we can see that they're very, very similar to each other. Now, how did these two sites communicate with each other? If we look at the coinage, there are two possible ways for ships to get from Patanam to Erikamedu. One would be overland, and they would go through this gap in the mountains known as the Palgut Gap. And we do have a sprinkling of coins that might represent this overland traffic between the two sites. The red coins, which are primarily late Roman in date, really fill in the trail. There are quite a few gaps. The second route would have been around, all the way around Sri Lanka. And what we're really waiting for is some evidence from this part of India to of some Roman evidence to see if that may have been a route at some time. So one way of looking at the two assemblages, which still needs confirmation, is that Patanam was the entry point for this material that was then transported overland to Erikamedu. Why Erikamedu? Why the east coast of India? That wasn't very common during that time. Although it was not well known in the Roman documents, it was very important for the east coast trade of India, so it was an interregional trading center, and very important for the trade with Sri Lanka and further on to China. Now, very briefly, because I see I'm running out of time, I'm going to talk about the differences in the late Roman evidence in India, and then turn back briefly to the Red Sea during the late Roman period. There's very little late Roman amphorae in India, and there's only one site that has a sizable assemblage of say, more than 100 sherds, and that is this site of Elephanta. And what we find there at Elephanta is a range of Eastern Mediterranean amphora, which are very commonly exported throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. And I've indicated their source areas here, so you can match them up to the drawings. Now, these three are Eastern Mediterranean. This one was made in Aqaba, and it's particularly interesting because it really is almost restricted to the Indian Ocean trade areas. And this is showing you the distribution of these Aqaba amphora throughout the Indian Ocean. There's a few more sherds in India that aren't indicated on this map. So if I just say a few words about the Aqaba amphora, the dating in Aqaba itself seems to be from the 5th century. At Berenike, we may have it slightly earlier in the mid-4th century, and it's made into the early Islamic period. One interesting feature of these vessels are these red inscriptions, which normally, if they're legible, have Christian motifs on them, such as the Cairo. So their distribution across the Indian Ocean with these Christian symbols may be part of forming some social cohesion in the trade, which by this period there were many Christian merchants by this period. So this was a warehouse at Berenike where you can see there were many of these Aqaba amphora. But more generally, we know a lot about late Roman Berenike. Most of this area of occupation belongs to that period. We have our Ptolemaic features that we talked about earlier here, and some of the early Roman trash dumps here. But at present, there was a real boom period at Berenike during the 4th century. And of course, by this time, Qusair was completely silted up. Qusair was no longer functional during this period from the 4th century onwards. Most of the architecture at Berenike comes from the late Roman period. This is an example of a few different construction techniques. One of the, I think, the largest building on site was this Christian church, which had many artifacts with Christian iconography excavated from it. Just in the last campaigns, we've excavated this really fascinating shrine that is in the what is now in the silted up harbor. There was an island in the silted up harbor at some point in the history. And this shrine has a number of interesting features. It has these benches that were covered in tamarisk matting and bones from mostly sheep for feasting. It has this interesting coral, piece of coral that was clearly a cult object, and a piece of basalt. And around these features were many, many wooden bowls, over 100 wooden bowls that had burnt remains in them. We call it the Lotus Temple because another feature was this reused Egyptian amphora that had the seeds of many different kinds of plants in it, including lotus plants. And also within this shrine, we found this bull, the statue of a bull, which of course raises many interesting questions about who was worshipped in this. Was it Apis? Was it Mithras? But importantly, the iconography of this bull is actually South Arabian. So whether we have still a South Arabian element on site is a very interesting idea. In the latest subphase of this, we also have these two altars, and this one particularly is very South Arabian in design. The later phase of this shrine is completely different. The coral has been covered up, filled in, the basalt is covered up, and the altars are still in use here. But there's a much more Egyptian flavor to many, many of the artifacts. And we see here some of the cult objects that came out of that shrine. Now, the inscription, although it is reused because we're in the 5th century and this is a trigenic inscription, was dedicated to Isis, Tyche, and possibly Serapis in AD 98. And we see here, within all the artifacts, quite an association with Isis, who would have been important for the safety of sailors before they set out on what was this very dangerous journey. And this may be an explanation of why we have so many shrines and so many religious buildings at Berenike, because sailors and merchants wanted protection before they set off onto the unknown. This is a pot from Aswan, another reused pot that was found in the latest phase of the shrine, which contained about 50 silver lunettes. And this is a small bowl made in Aswan with a diameter of about 12 centimeters. And these bowls were the most abundant find, ceramic find, within the shrine. And we discovered that many of the animal bones were cut exactly to fit into these small bones. So we had very good evidence of ritual feasting within this shrine. Again, like in the early Roman period, we had a wide range of Mediterranean goods, slightly more restricted in scope, fitting in with what we know of Roman trade during this period. And we continue to have a wide range of Indian artifacts, despite the lack of late Roman amphora in most of India. We know that the trade with India was still really important. We know that by these artifacts, and we know it by the immense size of Berenike during this late Roman period. Amongst the pottery that's imported from beyond the Roman Empire, we have a difference now. We have things from that came via the Gulf, so we have these Sasanian glazed wares and some of the torpedo jars from Mesopotamia or Iran. We have some local desert wares, and we have particularly these pottery types that came from Aksum. Now, it's a very old idea that in the late Roman period, the Aksumites became middlemen for the Romans in the Indian Ocean trade. But I think from the archaeological evidence, we do have hints that this is one facet of the trade in the late Roman period. And just to point out these different connections here, here we have Aksum and its port Adulis, which were very active internationally in the late period. And then here they are on this map. And then we have these connections via the Persian Gulf. To summarize what's happening in the late Roman period, we do have changes in which ports were important. We seem to have more infrastructure present at Berenike, particularly in the religious structures. And we have some differences in the range of trade goods that are coming in from India. We don't really have the ceramics during the late Roman period that were so abundant. Instead, we have more ceramics coming in small numbers still, but more than in the early period from East Africa. So to conclude, I hope that I've shown you today the changing patterns during the early Roman and the late Roman period, how those changes were affected on the Red Sea. And this final image is a pepper pot found in the UK, a silver pepper pot found in the late Roman period. And I find it such a striking visualization of the importance of the trade with India continuing through the late Roman period and percolating into the Roman Empire. Thank you very much.